Hello. I'm Earl Fontenelle, and this is Roots of Magic, a series of discussions of the history of magic with members of the research center Magea at the University of Würzburg.
Hello, this is The Schwepp, the secret history of Western esotericism podcast. It's Roots of Magic again, folks, and today we're speaking with Sara Chiarini, classical philologist and epigraphist, working between the University of Potsdam, where she's generally based, and Würzburg, where she's part of the Magea program, on the ancient corpus that keen listeners to our podcast know and love, namely the Greek magical papyri and other data for ancient religion. Very interested in the sort of more personal, more interior, more experiential sides of ancient religion. In other words, the really difficult stuff to talk about, right?
Personal belief. Yet again, papyri, but along with other sources as well. Yeah. I've worked currently still from time to time work on curse tablets, but currently at the at the Magea group, I'm focused mostly on the so-called magical papyri from Greco-Roman Egypt. And I am studying them through, I'm working on a couple of papers, all, centered on these papyri, but addressing some different questions. But we can, reasonably say that the sort of common theme is indeed that of efficacy and authority, and the belief in the, in the efficacy and the force and the actual, results that these practices could bring in the life of the practitioners.
That is a fascinating and, again, difficult territory to navigate. And I love that we're going to be talking about it today. Before we get into the richer, more interesting, more problematic side of your work, namely, how do we even start to talk about quote unquote real religious belief or religious experience, this sort of thing, in ancient religion or in any religion? There's a more cut and dried, basic typological part of your project, which we can maybe start with because it's going to kind of it's not that problematic. It's probably quite useful for scholars. It's just like a good solid piece of interpretation and scholarship. Namely, you've been looking at all the different kinds of divination practices we have in the papyri, and you've sort of cataloged them and made a typology. So
yes,
tell us about your results. What kinds of divination practices do we find in this material?
Well, it's interesting because these practices, these divinatory practices, I prefer to call them or to group them in the broader within the broader category of practices related to the gaining of knowledge in a broader sense. So we tend to consider divination as, anything concerning or anything related to the knowledge of the future, of future events, of what's going to happen. But this is not it's a limited perspective, it's a limited approach if we regard these sources. These rituals were essentially meant to increase the knowledge of the practitioners in different ways, including also knowledge of the past, a better knowledge of the past, encountering a divine being in order to ask them for any sort of information about their lives, about lives of other people in the community, and so on and so forth. So, or more theological, metaphysical, more deep questions about life.
So not like, will my chariot win the, which chariot team should I bet on next week? Although we do get that kind of thing.
We do have that.
But also, like,
we have the whole range.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have exactly the whole range from the most basic, most daily, most material requests and until up to the most theological matters that were pursued through these practices. So I prefer to talk about practices for the acquisition of knowledge rather than simply of divinatory practices.
Yeah, if I could just interject to bring things out.
Absolutely.
To a broader historical frame, I've toyed with the notion of talking about something like knowledge magic as a category. Mm. Now, magic is always dodgy when you want to bring in, you know, construct a useful analytic term. But when I think of things like the high medieval tradition known as Ars Notoria in Western Europe, mm-hmm. which is just entire, it's you're talking to angels, getting angels to work for you, but all they're doing is teaching you the liberal arts, like and maybe deeper questions of theological importance. It's just about knowledge. And in the much older texts known as Hechelot texts, we have this figure called Sartora, who's an angel who basically just helps you learn Torah. He's like a learning assistant. So there is a great deal of addressative ritual aimed at just learning stuff. And when that stuff is hidden, when it's a sort of hidden special divine knowledge, we are in the territory of the esoteric, right? This is exactly what makes it esoteric.
Yes,
so we see this in the PGM. That's good to know. What kind of typologies did you come up with within that overarching research question about practices to gain knowledge?
Yeah. So basically there are various paths, various ways that were, various methods that were conceived and elaborated in order to reach this additional hidden knowledge. First and foremost, maybe the best known one, because we know it also from the official religion, let's call it like that, official state religion, which is oracle. Mm? The directly asking a god question and then waiting for the signs and interpreting the signs coming from the gods. And this could be, of course, the basic sort of oracle rituals that we find in the papyri are essentially of the same sort that we know from the official religion, as I said. So looking at the sky, looking at the birds, looking at the entrance of the animals. So the same sort of, sacrificing an animal and looking at the inner parts, mostly the liver, and so on and so forth. So we have these kind of practices in the papyri as well, but they are not as common as the other ones, which are, let's say, also from a practical point of view, more doable for an individual, namely dream divination, which is, if I remember correctly, but I think I'm right, the most common one. Most common type of divinatory practice. So where you lie, so you prepare yourself, you lie in a well-prepared, carefully arranged room, you sleep, and then you wait for the dreams to come and interpret these dreams, in order to get the answers to the question that you're carrying and you want to find a response. And then we have more typically Egyptian kinds of ritual that were then borrowed by the Greeks there as well, but they are not originally Greek. So these two, oracle and dream divination, dream divination is attested equally both in the Egyptian as well as in the Greco-Roman world. So they have their own tradition of dream divination or dream practices, knowledge practices. But then we have the more typically Egyptian practices that were adopted by the Greeks then as well, namely bowl and ichnomancy, so light lamp divination. In this case, you would, as in the case of the bowl divination, you would put water inside a bowl and then pour oil on it. And then you would look at the shapes made by the oil drops, and you would interpret these shapes that were generated, and then you would interpret these. And in the case of lamp divination, it's kind of similar. Namely, you would turn on a special lamp. Again, the preparation is very important here. No? All the practices leading to this moment of lighting the lamp or of pouring the oil is, you know, very thoroughly described. But then you would switch on this lamp, and then you would look at the flame, and you would look at the shapes made by the flames from this, you know, coming from this lamp. And in these both cases of lamp and bowl divination, you could perform these rituals either alone as a practitioner, or, and this is very often the case, with the help of a child medium.
Would this be a virgin boy by any chance?
Yes. It's always a boy, and it's always for adolescence, basically. Yeah. So this child must be in an age where there is not yet the sexual development,
yeah,
you know, of the sexual organs hasn't yet happened.
This is a motif that goes right through to late European, well, like the assistant in the Iromanthia of Solomon,
yeah,
which survives from the 15th century. No one knows really how old it is, but it's definitely medieval, East Roman, you know, so Greek language sphere, magical manual. Again, you got to get the prepubescent virgin boy as your assistant for some of these divination practices. So that's a lovely bit of continuity. But we have this lecanomancy and these forms of divination done solo as well, right? So there's,
yes, absolutely. Okay, so it's not a must. More often than not, we find the presence of a medium, of a child medium, but it's not a requirement. It's not a must. It's only mostly the case,
right,
but it's not a requirement. And then just to finish the categories, we have the last category, which can be grouped around the term of cleromancy, namely any kind of practice based on dice or throwing out the number, a cipher. I include in this category also the Homeric, the mantic practices.
Yeah.
Yes, the Homeromantion or Manteion. So where you basically you take out a number from a bowl with the pebbles marked with numbers. You take out one, and then you go in this list of Homeric lines of Homeric hexameters, and then you read, you know, the and the Sortes Astramsaki are basically the same thing. I don't know if anyone is familiar with this term of the Sortes Astramsaki. Basically, it's the same kind of cleromancy based on taking out a number. In this case, however, there is a more complex mathematical calculation to be done before landing to the right number,
okay,
of the list, you know, that they had. And in this case, the line that you read, the line that you find next to the number, is no longer a numeric verse, but it's a sentence, basically. And all these kind of things from yes, no, or look at the next. So they are, as we know, you know, from nowadays astrology practices, so where these sentences are tend to be quite generic and quite applicable,
yeah,
to different types of questions,
yeah,
and you know, and we find the same there.
Even the well-known magic eight ball. Are you familiar with the magic,
yeah,
eight ball? You know, I mean, that's essentially, you know, the same,
yeah,
the same kind of thing. Bring in the Sortes Virgilianae, which was very popular, yeah, in Western medieval Europe, where you take the text of the Aeneid and subject,
yeah,
it to the same thing. Like, let's find out what we need to do, do this little practice, find a line from the Aeneid or two lines maybe, read them and go, okay,
yeah,
what is this trying to tell us, you know? And people still to this day, you know, sort of old-timey Christians in places like the United States are well familiar with the practice of just opening the Bible at random and reading the first line that comes to your eye. That's the super, super, super basic version of this, where,
yeah,
without even the magical, yeah, you know, preparations and the numerical.
Yes, absolutely.
Practice.
So these are those practices which require the least effort, the least preparation, that can,
yeah,
be done really, you know, quickly. And it's not a big deal, you know, to perform this kind in comparison to the highest form of divinatory practices, which I do have to mention, I cannot miss them, which are the practices of so-called direct vision, which means to actually prepare yourself to the direct encounter with the divine spirit. And this can also occur through a medium. So it can also be that not you as a practitioner are going to meet the God, but your medium child. And that's interesting that in those cases, because in these recipes, there's always the you know, this invitation and this sentences which sort of recommend the practitioner to have something to write on hand in order to make sure that that you don't lose anything that the child you might say or might see and might describe to you, and then to be ready to write everything down. So it's very interesting in this case.
Yeah,
this kind of instructions.
And I assume
to be ready.
Yeah, be ready indeed. I assume this. This last category is where we would put the so-called mitras liturgi, right?
Yeah.
Where you don't have a medium, you are going to ascend to Mithras in the heavens, and he is going to, well, he's going to come out through the celestial gate and deliver an oracle at the end of the day. You're going to ask him whatever you want. And he's going to
at the end of the day, it's an oracle too, no? It's an oracle at the end, what comes from that practice. Well, the Mithras liturgy, it's a very, very complicated text because it looks so much different from the rest of our divinatory recipes. Not just for the length, which is huge, you know, in comparison with the standard sort of divinatory practice, divinatory recipes we have, but also for its deep philosophical aim. Some scholars actually questioned whether we should consider this section of PGM for an actual recipe, or rather part of a philosophical treatise that landed somehow, part of a Neoplatonic treatise basically, landing somehow through reasons we cannot really reconstruct, or through ways we cannot no longer reconstruct, but that somehow landed within a manuscript of you know, a handbook of magical recipes, and was then included in them, but actually it doesn't really fit with the rest of the of this literature, let's say.
That's a very tempting interpretation. It's unprovable, of course, but
yes, it's not mine, by the way. Just to make sure, that's not my way of reading it. But several suggested that because it's so strikingly special.
It is special, and it's, you know, the later Platonists are always talking about ascent to the gods. And from Iamblichus onward, they're talking about ritual practices for ascent.
Exactly.
And Proclus is always dropping these hints and whatnot. And you just think, maybe one of them wrote a treatise which actually included some instructions. And that's
exactly. So how to concretely,
And then you do have phenomenon in magical literature very commonly where a scribe will go through a long text and just take the practical bits out and be like, I don't need the rest of this. I just want the practical bits. We see this again and again. So someone reading a text like that would very well have been tempted to just pull out the how to do the ascent part of the text and, you know, put it into another magical miscellany, and away you go.
Yeah. A very appealing approach. And as I say, hypothesis, unfortunately, we cannot prove that.
Yeah.
And I honestly, since I am so reluctant in using the term magic when talking about these rituals, I try my best not to use it because I feel I don't do right to these peoples and to these cultures by using a label which is so much charged with, in nowadays, with sort of negative, you know, a negative shadow, let's say, that I prefer always to talk about rituals, private rituals. And in this sense, then one wouldn't even need, you know, to distinguish between more philosophical versus more magical sources. So one would consider them all as you know, as a whole belonging to a tradition, you know, of Neoplatonic inspiration, including more practical, as you say, more practical instructions.
Yeah.
But not, that's why I privilege the use of the term ritual.
Yeah.
Instead
I can
of
buy that.
Talking.
But
yeah.
I have no particular attachment to the word magic. We just end up using it no matter how hard we try not to, right?
Absolutely, yes. Unfortunately.
So that is a useful typology. We've got a whole range of practices aimed at gaining knowledge. On the one hand, the type of knowledge being aimed at can be from the extremely humble, everyday, just plain utilitarian knowledge to more complex knowledge, all the way up to potentially matters of deep theological and scientific import and, you know, gazing into the secrets of nature and the secrets of the gods.
Exactly.
On the other hand, there are methods, and you've sort of given us some. So you've got your Homeric sortes, your sort of, or just sortes, sortilegia approach, sortilege, where you you do some kind of mathematical randomizing thing with dice or little two-sided coins or whatever. You throw them, you add up the numbers, you do put it through some transformations, and then you have a kind of list that you go to, which is going to give you your result. You've got lamp divination. You've got bowl divination. All of these do have something in common in that they depend on randomness for part of their effectiveness, right? You need randomness to, like nothing is more random than the movements of a flame.
We call it randomness. They would call it a divine sign,
exactly.
Right? A divine message, because nothing is random in this culture, in this mentality. So that's exactly the purpose. So to wait for the divine sign to manifest itself.
So creating what you might call creating randomness is actually creating a space for the gods to give their message,
reveal.
Because
Absolutely.
A lot of material stuff is too, like, you can't just have a rock and be like, okay, gods, talk to me, because the rock just sits there. But if you have oil on water, which has a tendency to move around, that the gods can get in and reveal something to you. Great.
Absolutely.
And then we have a few outliers like the Mithras liturgy, which is an actual ascent practice for going up into the heavens and meeting the gods in their world.
Yeah, but you could include also some among these sort of direct vision practices. You can also include like those vision of the sun.
Yeah.
Where you climb on top of a house and then you wait for, you know, midday, really. And then you have to cover yourself, of course, to protect your eyes with black ink. So you basically really, you know, cover your lids, eyelids. And then you try to look through and see, you know, the shape of the sun and the rays of the sun. In this case, it's called really the meeting encounter with Helios. Or Ra, so really with the divine encounter, and not just an interpretation of an indirect sign like the lamp could be. So in this case, it's also a case of direct vision, a direct encounter with the divinity.
And our colleague and friend Korji Dasu wrote his PhD on what he calls rituals of apparition in the PGM. Do you find this a useful category? Because this would be another way of describing anything where a god is going to appear to you or to your assistant.
Yeah. Yeah. So from the more mediate to the more immediate or direct way. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, this is a great way of structuring and thinking about the kinds of knowledge magic or knowledge practice that we find in this range of texts. Now, this maybe brings us to the more interesting, difficult part of your research. And actually, the Mithras liturgy gives us a perfect example of this, because in the Mithras liturgy, we have at a certain point a scribal voice saying, I tried this ritual with this variation and it worked great. Right. Now we get these little interventions from scribes. Like, you know, these texts have been written and rewritten. And in the days before printing, every time you're rewriting a text, you have the chance, if you want to just, you know, kind of get involved in the text. And people did in this genre very often. And often we can't tell how many different voices have been in a text, because marginal notes, when the next time the text is copied, often get inserted into the main text. So you know, these are very, very hybrid living texts. Tell us about
exactly
what you're finding with these sort of, you know, there's a whole bunch of different types of marginal comments we get, but you're particularly interested in the sort of ones where the where someone says this worked or this didn't work, or like this definitely works, this is a great method, this sort of like authenticating stamp of approval type.
Exactly. And I can briefly explain you why I'm focusing on that, because there are this is not the only strategy that could be adopted in order to grant or ensure the authority and the efficacy of a text, of a recipe. There were different strategies, and the others, actually, which of course are more interesting from some point of view, have been studied partly already. I refer mostly to the work by Jaco Dielemann, who in his great monograph on the Leiden and London papyrus devoted a chapter 6.4 to be precise, to exactly these strategies to promote the authority and the efficacy of these of the recipes. And he categorizes them and analyzes them and mostly focuses on one of these categories, which is also present in the Mithras liturgy, namely the reference, the attribution of a recipe to an authoritative, a famous author, a famous magician, a famous source, let's say, more in general. So be it in expressions like this recipe stems from the archive of the temple of Hermes in Hermopolis, and so on and so forth. So these kind of statements, which are most often at the beginning of the recipe, so like an introduction before the instructions begin.
Yeah.
So these kind of statements are also part of this strategy to promote the authority of the text. So attributing them either to an authoritative source or to an authoritative place of origin. So we have, like, for instance, we have statements like this recipe was copied among several ones, was chosen among several copies from the archive of a temple or from a, you know, famous priest. Then we have another strategy, which was recently studied mostly by Edmonds, which is the silencing strategy. This stress that we find very often in this case it occurs rather at the end of the recipe. This instruction and this appeal to the readers not to reveal the recipe to anyone else, to keep it secret, to keep it safe, to not spread it around, because otherwise it will lose its power.
Yeah.
And there's a nice article, recent article by Radcliffe Edmonds on this. So I chose that I realized that the part that was missing in this analysis was this third strategy. Namely these statements of efficacy, which really look like glosses, especially because Dielemann devotes very little attention to that, like a few lines, and he says, well, this is part of the marketing strategy. So he really talks about marketing strategies when dealing with these expressions, with this formula, we could call like that. And I was wondering, well, this is a very modern way, you know, of regarding. It implies, you know, that these statements were from the very beginning, that no one basically believed in those statements from the very beginning, and that it was already all fiction from its, you know, from the very conception and from the very start of the practice of this tradition of including these statements. And I think it's perhaps not so, and that there must again have been a sort of belief in the and we come back to the topic of belief, a sort of belief in the truth of these statements. I would encourage to regard them not just as marketing strategies, as Dielemann suggested, but to look at them from a philological point of view, which means to look at how these what you were basically saying earlier when introducing this question, to regard these statements from a philological point of view means essentially to try to reconstruct how these sentences, how these statements of efficacy might have landed, might have entered the textual tradition, you know, of the copying of these handbooks.
Yeah.
And the most plausible idea, which was, by the way, brought about by Quack already, is to consider them as earlier glosses that actual practitioner, actual priests or experts, having these manuscripts on front of them and reading them and noting, you know, annotating them, added, you know, at the side of the main text, and that by way of copying, you know, these recipes over and over, kind of got englobed, you know, got subsumed in the main text, and ended up as being part of the text of the recipe. First point to be stressed. Yeah,
very good point. Can I add something before we go on to the second
Absolutely.
Point?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Another reason I don't like this term marketing here is because, although we can totally imagine, so we live in a society where marketing is a concept everyone is familiar with, and we can imagine a modern day divinatory specialist, say a professional astrologer, mm-hmm. who works in the marketplace and is making their living doing astrology. We can imagine them marketing themselves, right, in various different ways.
Absolutely.
But the relationship with the Greek magical papyri and commerce is not a priori clear. It's not clear that that these texts were for sale. I mean, magical texts are for sale in many different cultures, and practitioners sell their services in many different cultures. And we know that there were practitioners like astrologers who sold their services in antiquity. But it's not entirely clear that all of these texts were in any way in the market, or that there was a priori, you know, like, we don't have to assume that the keep this secret, don't share it with anyone, it's privileged esoteric knowledge codicil is insincere. It does label the work as privileged esoteric knowledge, and so it has a kind of speech act effect that makes you go, ah, this is the real stuff. That's true. But it can also just be sincerely true, right? Like, someone who gets this manuscript, it's been given to them by a trusted teacher who's like, now you can copy this, but don't give the copy to anyone. And they just take that literally and, you know, believe it and take it seriously. Hence, we only have, for example, only one thing even remotely like the Mithras liturgy that survives. Presumably that's, you know, if trying to factor in the randomness of survival of papyri, that has something to do with the fact that this genuinely was material that wasn't just copied and thrown out everywhere, but was kept within, you know, certain select groups. So marketing doesn't quite do the job. Marketing also wants to project a capitalist mode of dissemination of information back into antiquity, which was not a capitalist society. We need to resist that kind of thing because, I mean, yes, they had money, but they weren't capitalists. There was no marketing in the modern sense. So that just doesn't fit.
Oh, yes, to try to defend a little bit Dieleman, it might be that he meant, with the term marketing strategy, that he meant maybe the competition, a sort of competition and concurrence within the circles,
right,
you know, of the practitioner.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I agree with you that the term is unfortunate. Again, once again, not very much, well, my sense of disturbance that I was feeling when reading this term came rather from this idea, okay, they didn't believe in what they wrote. You know?
Right.
So I felt uncomfortable with the idea that from the very beginning, these expressions, these statements were lies. From,
yeah.
You know, so this I can't cope with this idea.
Mm.
As far as the marketing, you know, the term marketing goes in the sense of selling, I totally agree with you. And I think, as again, it was an unfortunate choice. But I suppose that Dileman did not mean actually there was a market for these books.
Right.
I think that the way he uses it, when you read him, you feel that the way he uses it is rather in place of concurrence. You know, is rather meant to replace or to be a more a catchier term used in place of more moderate ones like concurrence and rivalities amidst the circles the groups
competition
of practitioners. Rather more competitive atmosphere in the close circles of these experts rather than an actual selling.
Dileman, we'll definitely give him a pass on that. He probably was never expecting to scholars of magic to come along and close read his use of one word.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Fair enough. Now, okay, so that's point one that you've come to think about with these effectiveness comments. What else have you noticed or been struck by?
Well, this idea by Kwok, I found, as I said, I found actually is basically everything Kwok writes. I am a great fan of him. I love what he writes, and everything he does is so founded and strong. And so is
Joachim Kwok, the Egyptologist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, from Heidelberg. Great respect for him. But moving from this observation, this possible idea of glosses entering the text, then this opens up, a whole range. So when we move one step beyond the mere philological explanation for these statements, then the whole world of questions, opens up, which basically turn around this huge, big question of they actually seem to have believed that these things work. That, I don't know, let's take one of among these several many rituals, taking a virgin lamp, taking a pure virgin papyrus roll, burn it to turn on the lamp, and pouring special herbs on the fire, and this and this and this and that would have finally produced the effect of, invoking the presence of the god, which in turn would have revealed itself and fulfilled all the purposes of the practitioner. So when I read, I tested it 10 times and it worked, I must believe in what I read. I mean, I cannot read these sentences, these statements, and think, well, this is all fiction. This is all part of the rhetoric of the recipe. If I agree with Kwok that these were glosses, right?
Right.
Yeah. So this automatically brings us to the question of how the hell did they establish that practice had worked or hadn't worked? And why, so from an experiential, from the experience of these people, what in their personal experience of these practices would have led them to state whether that practice had worked or not? And I, I have to say, I'm mostly working on divinatory recipes currently, so I focused mostly on them. But I think that my approach could be extended also to other kinds of ritual practices. And I essentially try to comprehend the sort of psychocognitive phenomena occurring in the mind, in consciousness of the practitioner, of practitioners of these kind of rituals while they are practicing them, and to try to link, this neuro psychological and cognitive experiences with those statements. Mm-hmm. And so we enter here the sphere, of rather of psychology than philology or religious studies in this case, because we have to really consider the kind of really the kinds of reactions of, you know, physical, physiological also reactions and effects that certain environmental, material, chronological factors play. Yeah.
Sensory, you know, sensory factors. Like if you're gazing, if you're in a dark room and you're gazing at a flame flickering, that has certain effects, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. And if you consider especially the divinatory practices, you will see that they tend to be extremely complex, multi-step, lasting several days, including several, you know, the use of different types of material sources and formulae and so on and so forth. So they are complex by themselves, so that it is very easy to do a tiny step wrong, which would automatically explain you, if it, the ritual at the end, you know, doesn't work, would give you automatically, you know, the explanation of why it didn't work. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you could appeal to, oh, shit, I forgot, you know, to add that herb. I forgot to do three steps instead of two, and turning left and turning right, because there are also lots of divinatory rituals that require sort of dance movements, right, which are very funny, like on the roof. You know, on the roof of the house, you have to do some kind of dancing as well. So you can basically have thousands of options. You can appeal to factors you can consider as being responsible for not succeeding.
Right.
Hmm? And on the other hand, the success. So it's easier to explain when what the failure in this way. Mm-hmm. But how to explain the success of these rituals? Well, through this sensory experience that you were mentioning. So if we imagine most of these divinatory ritual, with exception of the Helios one, you know, from the mm-hmm. Rooftop, most of them, I mean, the all the lamp, all the oil bowl, all the dream, basically the great majority of divinatory or knowledge rituals happen in a completely darkened room, ideally underground. So you have this complete atmosphere of complete darkness where you cannot really tell what time of the day is, and you already have this estrangement, you know, this yeah. feeling of, you know, uncomfortable feeling of knowing
yeah.
what time of the day it is.
I have a really visceral example of that in my own life, which is if I ever go to the cinema to see a film during the day, mm-hmm. and then I come out of the cinema and it's still light outside, I'm just like, wow, what's going on? No, this
see.
Is wrong.
You know? See.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And this is a neuronal reaction, which yeah. is totally correct, you know, and part of your body, you know,
right.
which, you know, cannot really understand why suddenly you were in a dark, you were in the darkness in the middle of the day. So, and imagine doing this while loads of incense is burning, and your eyes are covered. You haven't eaten anything for 3 or 4 days or 7 days. You have abstained from communicating, having contact with anyone for days, and so on and so forth. So imagine yourself in this physical situation, in this environment, with these substances, these fumigating substances. So if you sum all of these elements, the sort of visions, you know, that you that your mind might make you view, might make you perceive, become easily comprehensible, become easily applicable, let's say, to the result
right.
of a divinatory practices, right?
Mm. Yeah, this is really interesting. I mean, this is incidentally a strong argument why people like us who study these materials, these ancient practices, should try them out, right? Like the scholar practitioner, because you just don't know until you don't know what something tastes like till you've tasted it. You can talk about
it. Yeah, I do. I do workshops on cursing.
that's a little dangerous. That's a different story.
Yeah, with both students, actually, and also pupils at school. But it's funny because that's a very nice social experiment to do, because when I tell them, I bring them tiny tablets and I let them write and draw and roll, and then when it comes to the hammering, the madness, the rage, all the feelings, come out, pour out from these kids. So while they're hammering on this poor tablet, and so it's very interesting to observe. Mm. So I do agree. I totally agree with you that to put into practice this recipe is the best way to really figure out how the experience. Yeah. Might have affected the practitioner.
Yeah, it can't hurt anyway. It can't hurt.
No.
Now, this is interesting to me because here on the Schwepp and in the halls of German academe that you inhabit, there is a kind of methodological assumption that the gods aren't real, magic isn't real, in quotes, right? So that when something works or doesn't work, in quotes again, we're looking for psychological explanations, or let's say naturalistic explanations. And you can see how these practices often have like a built-in fail-safes against failure. So, it's if it failed, it's because you left out a step or whatever. And if it's and the other naturalistic thing that comes in, most obviously, is a confirmation bias. So when it works, you're like blown away. It worked once. That means this thing just works. So what logicians call the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy is in full effect. If you got the information and then the thing happened, like the information said, therefore, causality. And that's all well and good, I feel like. But on the other hand, what exactly do we think these people think the gods are? Such that that's a contradiction. They might, if you imagine an ancient practitioner of one of these arts being transported to our time and learning a modern language, and then we're sitting down to talk about how it works when, you pour the oil on the water and you see in the shapes the certain things, and we say, well, this is like psychological, you're preparing yourself psychologically, and then you're in this certain receptive state such that when you see these certain shapes, your unconscious mind, maybe this is the sort of Freudian invention or whatever part of your psychology kind of kicks in a way that it's been prepped to do, and you go, it's this and this and this. And I could imagine an ancient person being like, you're talking about the gods. I don't know what this unconscious mind thing is that you're talking about, but I think my positing of the gods is just as plausible as this unconscious mind. Like, where is this unconscious mind notion coming from? Do you see what I mean? The idea that there has to be a binary, it's either the gods or it's your subconscious.
No, I think we are missing a third element here, and I would like to throw it in the play here, namely culture. That is the social culture environment in which one grows, which is fundamental. And I also have an anecdote on this. Go because on. Recently we had at the Magaya a talk by an Egyptian pharmacist who came and told us some stories, from a village close to Edfu, where Martin excavates, and he's his landlord. And he invited him over to Würzburg to tell us about, nowadays practices, ritual practices in his village, but in the region as well. So an educated person, he's a pharmacist. He has a degree in pharmacy. And he told us some stories, including also some personal stories. Several people were like, while listening to him, European listeners had at several points of his speech had to sort of hold their laugh, Right. Because he was really earnest, he was really seriously talking about, a girl being bewitched and how he saved her and so on and so forth. And I didn't very much listen to the stories themselves, but rather I paid more attention to the way he told them and what kind of explanations, you know, he gave, you know, around surrounding these stories. And I noticed how much, and this is, I think, the hardest part for us, you know, scholars coming from a completely different cultural environment to try to understand, you know, the dynamics, cultural dynamics behind these practices. The idea that entire nature, that the entire world, that everything around us is full of God, is full of divine force, which just waits to manifest itself, to become present, become visible to the human mortals. This is totally foreign to us, mm-hmm. but it's deeply, deeply rooted in these people. So when he said, for instance, he said, well, I am short-sighted. I've been short-sighted since I was a child because I was bewitched, I was cursed. And I went to any doctor, ophthalmologist I consulted. They couldn't help me. They couldn't heal me. And in fact, this curse, I realized I was cursed and I wasn't able to free myself from this curse. Of course, I was thinking, well, myopia cannot be healed, you know, this is just myopia. But I was wrong. You know, I was wrong in applying this, you know, my approach, because if I, you know, I forced myself to step out of my own, you know, very Western, you know, scientific way of, you know, of regarding phenomena, and try to, as best as I can, you know, to imagine, you know, and to view the world in that other way. And if you try to immerse yourself in that kind of cultural environment, everything makes sense. Everything in context of these practices has a sense, has a meaning, and has an efficacy.
Right.
You know?
Right. Although, unfortunately for our gentleman, it wasn't effective in none of the practices were effective in lifting the curse, which is a bummer. Presumably he's a specky
Yeah. No, because just like me. But he had an explanation for that. He had, of course, an explanation for that, namely that if I remember well, he wasn't able to find the, you know, because in order to counter curse, you have to find the origin of the curse. So he was unable to find the culprit.
Yeah.
And that's why, but that's not important. So he never considered the fact that myopia is incurable. I am also short-sighted, but I know that, you know, I don't feel cursed for this reason, but it's interesting, you know? So you start having a symptom and the first thing you do is not, I go to the doctor, but okay, who
did this to me?
Who did that to me?
Yeah.
That's the first thought of these people. And it's extremely, I mean, it's fundamental. If we lose that, if we do not take it into account when interpreting these texts, we are missing the whole thing, you know?
Right. Being ironically somewhat myopic in our reading, one might say, aha. Now, this brings us to a huge and, you know, a huge intractable, difficult territory, which your work is swimming in and, you know, sort of bravely trying to deal with. So on the one hand, we can do our best to read sympathetically and try to enter into the thought world of the people who wrote the texts that we're reading, if we're working on texts, which you are. And in this case, we have a huge gap of time as well, right? And time and worldview. So although there are many continuities that we see between the Greek magical papyri and much later magical practices down to the modern age, that being said, there are also great differences in how late antique Greco-Egyptians saw the world and how we see the world. So there's going to be some limitations to how much genuine sympathy we can have, but we do our best. And that's what you've just been talking about is an example of a scholar trying to do their best to bridge that gap. So that's great. But this does abut against a big methodological question. And I would even broaden this out to the study of ancient religion more generally. I wonder if you could, in closing, just give us your thoughts on this, because there's been a big debate in what you might call classics more generally, not so much people interested in the stuff we're interested in, but just people working on ancient Greek religion or even ancient Greek mythology, as though that's some kind of non-religious phenomenon or somehow separate from religion. And it's kind of the debate, I would call it the, did the ancients really believe in their gods debate? Now, I don't think this debate is useless. I think it's a very useful debate, but I think very absurd positions have been taken in it. So on the one hand, did the ancients believe in their gods in a kind of propositional way, the way Protestant Christians believe that Jesus is their personal savior, as a sort of propositional? No. That notion of belief, right, that often dominates discussions of what it is to believe religiously, right? That this is a very specific Protestant form of belief that can be traced historically. So forget about that. We agree that the ancient Greeks weren't into that sort of thing. But having exactly. swept that away, there's still this debate. Like there's a hard position that says the Greeks did not believe in the gods. And I've read articles that make this claim. They just belief has nothing to do with it at all. All they believed in was the necessity of doing certain rituals. And often it's even interpreted into this sort of like, there is no personal aspect to ancient Greek religion. It's just state cult. It's this sort of social solidarity, social regeneration process whereby you go out to the whatever the festival is and everyone does the special rituals. And then for another year, we are the Athenians again. Yay, you know, this sort of model. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you have read works like the PGM or the Hermetica or the Chaldean Oracles or the evidence from Aelius Aristides or the New Testament, for God's sake, like it's very clear that ancients in the Greco-Roman world had deep personal relationships with their gods, that they thought about their gods, that they communicated with their gods, for God's sake. I mean, like, this is what a lot of these rituals are for. It's for direct communication. Like, I feel this way about Serapis, but I need to really talk to Serapis about this particular matter that's interesting me. So we need to have a dream conversation, right? So to me, that debate is a really interesting one. I wonder if you could just reflect on your take on this question, even if you can't say, well, these are my findings, because obviously it's a hugely difficult problem.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And this is really at the root of our reflections on you know, for us as historians of ancient cultures and religions. I think whenever we try to figure out the kind of relationship between the humans and these divine beings in ancient society, I think, once again, we are very much affected by the literary descriptions of these gods, of these, you know, pantheons, of these stories related to these gods, which, however, represent the product of poetic and literary re-elaboration on a tradition that surely had, you know, had a long story, dated back to centuries of oral transmission, oral tradition. But the way many poets, I'm thinking mostly of, you know, tragedy and comedy, and many other authors, who, however, represented the very tiny elite in these society, the way in which these authors depict these gods might not have necessarily, you know, matched with the way in which the majority of the people carried and lived, you know, lived their relationship with these same gods. So what I want to say is, I think that on the level of normal citizen of a Greek polis or you know, of the or of a city of the Mediterranean coast. Mm-hmm. Besides the participation, you know, in the in these state rituals, which was obligatory for citizens.
Yeah.
So you couldn't really discuss very much whether you wanted or not to go, or and how much, you know, involvement was included there. But let's try to rather focus on the, again, the intimate, the kind of relationship, what you were mentioning. You know, I have an issue. I want to know the opinion of the god of my town, of my sacred god, of my personal, you know, of my personal god, because everyone had their, you know, favorite.
Yeah.
You know, favorite god, favorite divinity. They preferred, you know, to honor and to you know, to celebrate with their rituals. So in this case, of course, these gods, you know, were actual presence, you know, were an actual presence in the lives of these people. And I don't think that they imagined them or related to them the same way an Aristophanes did,
right.
You know. So I think that it was a much more intimate, personal, individual relationship with that god, which was respected, you know, in the community and taken seriously, you know, and also rather positively, you know, connotated. And
right.
Then, of course, there is this other more intellectual, more elitarian, literary portrayal of this pantheon, which makes us, of course, wonder how could it possibly be, you know, that these people believed in these so human gods, you know,
flawed and
erratic,
you know, yeah,
erratic, and you know, chaotic and erratic gods. So I think there are, once again, one should distinguish, you know, the social context and the personal experience of living in a community which, you know, honors a certain god, and in which I do believe that belief was amongst the people honoring and you know, worshipping that divinity, and try to separate the different levels with which these gods have been presented, you know, in literary sources to us.
This makes sense. This makes a lot of sense. I think to take a more modern example, I just keep thinking of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you see God the Father as a bearded guy reaching mm-hmm. out to touch fingers with Adam. And I don't think anyone has a problem imagining Michelangelo being both pious and a believer in the Christian God, and also painting that painting, right?
Exactly.
Even though if you were to ask him, do you literally think God has like a yellow robe? He'd be like, no. What are you talking about? You know, but this is a valid artistic expression of certain aspects of faith and the
exactly.
story of humanity. And also, God is the universal creator and, you know, much bigger than any one depiction can. And maybe that's a bit easier to get into mind-wise because it's more modern. It's a more, you know, it's closer to us. Like you can just have both.
Yeah, well, this actually opens the big issue of the means that we have to talk about the gods. No, you know, how limited, you know, this is a you know, as old as humanity. No, this debate of how to talk about the gods and how limited our, you know, our means are to be able to speak or to describe or to, you know, the Neoplatonists made, you know, their living out of this, you
right,
know, the inability of humans to describe, to even talk or even name the god. So that's as all that. So this is the compromise, you know, artists, poets and so on, they use their poor human means, you know, to depict and to describe and to chant, you know, the gods, but nothing will be ever close you know, to their actual entity, you know.
Mm. Transcendence, the old problem of transcendence.
Yeah.
This is exactly. Another notion that we sometimes see that, you know, the ancients, the really, really ancient Greeks, the Homeric Greeks, let's say, they didn't have a notion of transcendence. They didn't have a word for it, maybe, but that doesn't mean that there weren't aspects to life and existence that didn't fall outside what they could describe with language or depict in stone, right? Like there's, I think that's part of the human experience is you never get it all down on the page when you're trying to describe this reality we exist in. Sara Chiarini, thank you for talking about your work, talking about some of your findings with the magical papyri, a textual corpus that we never get tired of because it's so full of wonders. And also for leaving us on a note of aporia, swimming in this very, very difficult and fertile territory of trying to interpret the potentially not interpretable in a sensible and responsible way.
I thank you. It's been a true pleasure.
The pleasure's all mine. Until we have the pleasure of speaking again, I invite you to stay magical.